From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Many school districts are reluctantly cutting staff and dropping courses in response to tighter budgets, so educators are looking for ways to save money and improve instruction at the same time. In the first of two stories, NPR's Larry Abramson reports that some schools are turning to technology as a way to do more with less.
KIPP Empowerment Academy in South Los Angeles had to make a virtue out of dire necessity. Just as this nationwide network of charter schools was opening up a new kindergarten here, the amount of state money began to dry up. Principal Mike Kerr says he saw only one way out, raising class size.
We had to cut out one whole classroom, so we went from five classes of 20 to four classes of 28.
But how do you do that without eating away at quality instruction?
Okay, so before we move to reading groups, we're going to play Zoom.
The answer, Kerr says, was technology.
So they have about two more minutes on the rug, and they're going to rotate out to the computers.
Some kindergartners are wrapping up a small group vocabulary lesson. They will switch places with kids working on computers in another corner of the room. The computer kids will sit down with their teacher and work on reading.
She also had a problem with this word. Let's look at this word. Don't shout it out. Do you see any sounds you know?
Yeah.
Oh, so this word is?
Low.
Good. And also
the idea is to keep the feel of a small class without the cost of additional staff. When the kids are on the computers, they get help from Elizabeth Flotman. She's the school's technology consultant.
I can walk out of this classroom and work with the children in the other classroom for 5 or 10 minutes. And I feel like most of the time I can come back into the classroom and they're all engaged.
It is not easy for very young kids to learn how to work independently like this. Teacher MJ Mathis says KIPP students practice these things in the program's special summer school.
The biggest challenge for us is teaching them actually how to sit at a computer, how to use the mouse, how to enter their password. But, I mean, it literally is just another part of the curriculum. We teach them, okay, you stand up, you stand silently behind your chair, this is how we move.
In Northern California, rocket ship education has its own flavor of what's become known as blended learning, part computer, part classroom instruction. Rocket ship has three charters around San Jose. At Mateo Sheedy Elementary, kids rotate through classes the way high schoolers do. They go to the English teacher for English instruction, and they also spend 100 minutes each day here in Rocket ship's computer lab. Kids log in and start work on math or reading lessons appropriate for their grade level. The reading lessons follow the pattern of most digital learning. Kids read stories and are rewarded for the right answers. Third grader Samantha Hernandez knows how it works.
Right here, if you get 100, you get to get a sticker. And if you get like an 80, you were almost there.
Are the questions hard?
Sort of. When you didn't read it good, they are hard.
Yeah.
Music tells kids it's time to leave the computer lab so the next group can come in. With up to 100 kids in the lab at any one time, it gets pretty noisy, especially when lunch is going on in another corner of the room. Rocket ship admits the setup isn't ideal, but strong improvement at all three schools seems to show that something is working here. John Danner, the founder of Rocket ship, says the computer lab is a place to practice fundamentals, exercises that shouldn't be taking up valuable class time.
So if you can move the basic skills to the learning lab with tutors and technology, really there aren't a lot of teachers that would say, gosh, I really miss teaching that basic skill. They'd much rather teach kids how to think.
At Rocket ship, the computer lab is staffed by volunteers and members of the community. John Danner says that allows him to plow more money into other areas of instruction.
The main things that we reallocated to are higher salaries, 20% higher salaries for teachers, academic deans at every school that can work on the professional development of all the teachers at that school, and a 3-year leadership development program to make sure that the people that run our schools are excellent.
One of the upsides of having all your students online is that teachers get tons of data, reports on their students' computer work. Second grade math teacher Bailey Thompson gets regular printouts.
So this student completed 58 problems or 58 lessons in a given week here. And I know from conversations I've had with her in class that she enjoys and is engaged by the software and that she's moving forward even beyond concepts we've had in class.
There's a weak spot in the world of blended learning. Even enthusiasts will admit that software offerings are weak, especially for young students. we'll look at an unexpected gold mine in the otherwise boring world of online math in our next story. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
Quick, name a Chinese brand. Just one. The fact is, after 30 years of bone-shaking, mind-bending economic growth, everyone knows about brand China, but few can name a specific Chinese brand. As we continue our series on China, NPR's Rob Gifford tells us the reason for that is not just economic.
In a bustling market near the center of the Cambodian capital, Phnom Penh, 24-year-old Sore Pia is testing the ringtones on a cell phone she wants to buy. I'll definitely buy a Chinese-made phone, she says, because they're cheap, even though the quality is not great. But she doesn't know any Chinese brands, and in fact, the brand she's going to buy is a fake Nokia, copied in China and sold throughout Southeast Asia. This reputation for Chinese-made goods holds inside more upscale stores in Phnom Penh as well. Manager Tavi runs a smart store in a mall selling electronics.
No, we don't have Chinese brand. We got only Korean brand and Japanese brand. Because the Chinese product came to Cambodia for the first time, the product were very poor quality.
So a store manager in Cambodia puts his finger on a key point of China's rise. Cheap t-shirts and fake mobile phones, fine. iPads and laptops assembled for foreign companies, fine too. But Chinese brands, it's not really happening yet. Half a world away in Camden, South Carolina, American workers are attaching the seal on a refrigerator door. This is the American factory of Haier, a Chinese company that's probably the closest China gets to a known international brand.
I think we've got good people, we've got good management, we've got good products.
Manager Gerald Reeves says Haier is making quality goods, so it hasn't suffered from the image of low-end made-in-China products.
I don't know that it's really been a challenge, because if you look, you know, it says made in the USA on our boxes, and a lot of people don't even realize this is a Chinese company, truth be known.
Haier, he says, is investing plenty in research and development to keep their quality high.
We've got some R&D upstairs. You're going to build products for an American market. You need to have Americans, for the most part, designing those products.
But many analysts say that Haier's limited success may in some ways be the exception that proves the rule. They attribute China's inability to develop and innovate to problems within China that go deeper than just the development of brands. The lack of legal protection, for a start.
If you're going to innovate, if you're going to be entrepreneurial, if you're going to create and invent things, you need a legal system that can protect your invention.
Paul French of Shanghai consulting firm Access Asia has lived in China for nearly 20 years.
The government should take the lead on that, and an independent legal system needs to be able to do that and to respect the rights of entrepreneurs and innovators. And at the moment, that is simply not the case here.
French says intellectual property rights is one of many issues that need to be dealt with if China is going to move up to the next level.
The big picture would be the environment. The big picture would be social welfare, healthcare and pensions particularly. But then it would be education and the ability for students and academics to challenge the consensus, to challenge the official version of things. We need to have freedom of the press, so that the confidence in the stock market can be maintained. We're going to need better ethical and corporate governance, and that's going to mean a lot more transparency, both from government and from corporations.
Any one of those issues on its own would be hard enough to reform. The fact that China needs to reform all of them is a monumental, not to mention dangerous, task. Modern Chinese society is simply becoming too complex to be contained within the old political and social framework. And it's not just Westerners who say that some of the entrenched cultural and political attitudes have to change. Take education, for instance.
This room is very similar to what I used to have at Princeton University.
Chinese-born scientist Shi Yigong went to the United States in the 1990s to gain a PhD and rose rapidly to be a full professor of molecular biology at Princeton. In 2008, to his colleagues' amazement, he decided to give up his tenure and return to become Dean of Life Sciences at Tsinghua University in Beijing. He says he owes something to his homeland. Shi, like most people here, knows there is one word that sums up the challenges ahead.
Of course, it is a system. China do have a lot of talented scientists and engineers. People are very smart in China. But the mechanisms for people to apply their talents, for people to innovate, are not there yet. That needs to be resolved.
But the system, and indeed the culture, is very difficult to change. And Shi very honestly admits he sees the problems even in himself. He encourages his graduate students to innovate and to challenge their teachers in a way the Chinese education system does not. But he realized recently when his own children got home from school, the only question he asked them was, "Did you listen to your teacher today?"
For someone who stayed in the United States for 18, 19 years, who's been already influenced by Western culture, still the question was, "Did you listen to your teachers?" You know, we are told to listen. We are told to accept. We are told to not to doubt about authority. So I think that element is very hard to do away with because that's part of our culture.
Observers point out that discouraging students from questioning teachers is a political issue too. If you start to let kids question authority, who knows where that's going to end up? And anyway, surely you can't have all these reforms and continue to be a one-party state, can you?
Yeah, but you know, people said you can't have private property ownership in a one-party state.
Consultant Paul French of Access Asia again.
People said you can't have a banking system that gives out loans and mortgages in a one-party state. People even used to say you can't have a one-party state where people are just given passports and allowed to fly off to other countries because none of them will ever come back. Well, turns out you actually can have a one-party state and those things, right? You know, we're off the map here. I think we're going to find that there's a lot of things that you can have and still have a one-party state.
We are indeed off the map here. The extraordinary experiment that is modern China, staggeringly impressive though brutally flawed, is utterly off any map that has ever gone before. And there's possibly just one thing that could be more difficult to implement than the transformation the Communist Party has made in China over the last 30 years, and that's the transformation it needs to make over the next 30. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Shanghai.
Here's a milestone for China's global reach. A Hong Kong newspaper says the country is preparing for a sea trial of its first aircraft carrier. Since the Second World War, the aircraft carrier has been a measure of global power. The United States has deployed nuclear-powered carriers around the world with a symbolism that is often as forceful as the warplanes on deck. More recently, Britain announced plans to mothball its last active carrier, which is seen as a sign of British military decline. Now comes China's entry. China purchased a carrier years ago from the former Soviet Union. It needed refitting and new weapon systems. Now it will serve as a training vessel while China builds its own carriers. Sea trials could start on July 1st to mark the 90th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party.
Sales of cars in the U.S. are slowly rebounding, though they're still not at the peaks hit a decade ago. In 2000 and 2001, more than 17 million automobiles were sold in this country. Last year, that number dropped to just under 12 million. Many analysts, dealers, and executives believe the industry is actually healthier selling fewer cars, as NPR's Sonari Glinton reports.
So I'm sitting here at my desk. Now let's pretend I sell sharpened pencils. Now, you'd think I'd make more money if I sold 17 million pencils as opposed to, say, 12. But if you change the pencils to cars, that logic falls completely apart.
That 16 to 17 million sales level that we experienced was not a normal situation.
Jeremy Anwell is CEO of the car website Edmunds.com. He says a lot of the things that kept car sales high, we're not going to see again.
We saw over 20 years of declining interest rates. Car companies were pouring more and more incentives into the marketplace. A lot of the appreciation in housing was being taken out by consumers with second loans and then used to buy cars.
Also, because of work rules, it was often cheaper for the car companies to pump out cars rather than slow down production. Those extra cars, they almost gave away. Anwell says the economy has fundamentally changed, and with it, the auto industry.
So I think about a more normal marketplace where lenders are looking for 20% down, where interest rates are probably going to be climbing over the next 5 years, not declining, that getting up to 15 to 16 million is going to require really a growth in population.
So why does it matter if you sell 17 million cars rather than 12 million? I got a word for you. Jobs. Jobs at the parts supplier, the factory, the transportation company that ships the cars, the dealers that sell them, and on and on. Tammy Darvish runs car dealerships in Florida, Maryland, and Virginia. Listen to how she answers when I ask her how many dealerships she runs.
let's see, Toyota, Lexus, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
She kept counting for a while. Eventually, Darvish finally arrives at an answer.
31 franchises, 21 rooftops.
Darvish says she's not putting up the sales numbers the way she did a few years ago. However,
we're probably much better businessmen and women than we were 3 years ago. We're paying a whole lot more attention to expenses, expense control, collaborating between all of our business partners.
When Tammy Darvish says collaborating with business partners, she means the car companies. Detroit.
They spent years sort of jamming cars. There was a lot of pressure for us to carry inventory levels that were ridiculous. And then you're constantly in fire sale mode and to dump cars, and you're willing to take losses on them just to get them off your inventory.
Most of the dealers you talk to will say the restructuring in Detroit has affected the whole industry. Huddy Hyman is also a car dealer in Virginia. He says he's streamlined business, but he won't go on a crazy hiring spree when sales really pick up, and he believes they will.
You may not see $17 million, but you may see a real, real healthy $14, $15 million new car sales. And the way people operate today versus the way they operated 4 or 5 years ago, they're going to say, well, we can really make a good profit at that. It'll be better for us.
Hyman says he just hopes the industry doesn't forget the lesson. It just got finished learning. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Greece's prime minister survived a vote of no confidence today. Now he faces an even tougher vote on painful austerity measures, measures needed if Greece is going to get additional bailout money from international lenders. As NPR's Sylvia Pagioli reports from Athens, this comes as thousands of people continue to protest daily against devastating cuts already in place.
The demonstrators are not the usual leftist and trade unionist with red banners. They're mostly middle-class Greeks waving the white and blue national flag. A group of actors perform in the style of an ancient tragedy. Wearing farm animal masks, the Greek chorus chants the Orwellian phrase, "All animals are equal, but some are more equal than others." These Greeks are outraged by what they see as the injustice of draconian austerity measures that have driven unemployment to a record high 16% and extended the recession into its third year. By early evening, thousands of demonstrators stand before Parliament, shaking their fists, shouting, "Thieves, thieves!" They accuse politicians of dismantling the country's welfare state. Child psychiatrist Effie Bourla has protested in the streets against sharp cutbacks in public health. She says in her practice she has noticed a large increase in eating and sleeping disorders. Her young patients describe a recurrent nightmare about a big scary bear they all see in a TV cartoon.
Constantly live with a big frightening bear that is always behind us. Now I'm going to eat you. Now I'm going to take your job. No money.
Bourla says children's growing anxieties reflect those of their parents, burdened with mortgages and credit card debt. They hear their parents grappling with mysterious new words learned from TV, bond spreads, haircuts, and credit default swaps. Children are beginning to fantasize, she says, the bank is going to take away their home and even their toys. Bourla says she sees more children who refuse to go to school and insist on staying home to take care of their newly unemployed and depressed fathers. Klimaka is an NGO that runs a shelter for the homeless. A group of people sit in a quiet courtyard under a pergola. Until recently, it was mostly for immigrants. But the economic crisis has created a new homeless generation, ordinary, well-educated Greeks who have suddenly lost their steady incomes and their homes. They're at a total loss. Taxiarchis, he declines to give his last name, is 49 years old. He used to own a small coffee shop, but when he couldn't pay back the mortgage, the bank took away everything he owned. He's humiliated his life has so rapidly deteriorated.
People, they don't need more than a job to find themselves, to feel again that they are not rubbishes. They need just a job and some money to live in a house, live like I was living before, like normal human beings.
This is the office of a 24-hour suicide hotline. In the last year and a half, calls have increased by 250%.
It's not just an economic crisis, it's an emotional crisis. It's a crisis of values right now.
Aris Violatsis is a psychiatrist and volunteer. He describes the kind of person who calls in, a family man who always lived by the book, who is suddenly told you did everything wrong. And he says there's the added shock of the revival of old prejudices, being seen by Northern Europeans as lazy and living off the work of others.
Our identity is at stake because suddenly being a Greek is associated with something bad.
The turmoil in Greece has been seen primarily in economic terms and in its repercussions on the single European currency. But it's now also emerging that the harsh austerity measures imposed by Greece's international lenders could be undermining the sense of European partnership and tearing apart the country's social fabric. Sylvia Poldroli, NPR News, Athens.